From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today on the show, we wrap up our series on the end of the job lines with a look at some of the solutions for the transit issues facing the Milwaukee area. Then, Radio Chipstone wraps up with a look at how objects have been used to pigeonhole people.
The object lesson idea can be this powerful way to study material things, but it can often be a very dangerous way to study and think about people, because it encourages you to, based on your observations and experiences, make assumptions about that person.
And our Fit for You series visits the Womb Room, a place that goes beyond simply offering pre- and postnatal yoga classes.
For me, the emphasis is on not just including a pregnant person in a regular yoga class in a way that's safe for them, but creating community with other people that are in the same phase of life.
Lake Effect is next, but first, the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Joy Powers. All this week, we've been talking about the end of the job lines. The bus routes were meant to connect people in Milwaukee County to jobs in the suburbs. But as we've learned throughout the series, these lines weren't functioning the way local leaders had hoped. Ridership was low, and the financial burden to keep them running was simply too high. But the job lines were created to solve an issue that remains a problem in our area, connecting people who need work to the areas where there is work. So how do we move forward? Kevin Muse is the executive director of the Southeastern Wisconsin Regional Planning Commission, also known as SewerPAC. It's the metropolitan planning organization for the seven counties that make up Southeastern Wisconsin. Kevin, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thanks for having me.
You know, ultimately, this entire series has been about the last mile issue here in Milwaukee, specifically getting people from the central city to the suburbs where there are jobs. But I know this isn't just an issue for the Milwaukee area. How common is this kind of problem in metropolitan areas throughout the country?
It's a significant problem all across the country. In fact, there's some research that shows that in some ways we actually do relatively well in the Milwaukee area compared to a lot of peers at providing access to jobs via transit. And that has a lot to do with our land use pattern actually being relatively compact compared to many, more southern or western metropolitan areas. But all of them struggle with it. I think maybe what's different here is that it doesn't seem like we've gotten too far into trying some of the more creative things that some of the other metro areas seem to be trying. There are definitely some standout examples from across the country of partnerships with private entities to try to solve this problem. And I think that's the sort of thing we could explore further in our area if we had willing partners.
What are some of the options that really stand out to you when you look at different areas around the country?
Sure. There are a few different options that others are implementing. So one was an entity in, it's actually the city of Centennial, Colorado. They have a light rail station, but not really any local transit that connected to that light rail. So they did a partnership with, I believe it was Lyft, that essentially provided people within a certain radius around that light rail station a free ride to and from that light rail station. So they went to the main transit node and they were connecting all of their very spread out different land uses and development to that light rail station with essentially a subsidized trip by the local government and I think in partnership with a few different entities. There are also maybe more applicable in some ways to our metro area. There are some multiple locations across the country where they've replaced lower performing routes or they've extended routes using, again, Uber, Lyft, or in some cases, shuttle van type partnerships. And again, that's the sort of thing where you don't try to encourage people not to take the transit system. You use the transit system where it's efficient and effective, and you meet it there to pick people up and then distribute them to all these business parks or retail destinations or something like that.
And the solutions that you mentioned, they are things that people here are considering. You know, I spoke with someone from Waukesha County, and she said, you know, they're interested in exploring the options of Uber and Lyft, specifically subsidized, that mm-hmm. might be able to connect at Milwaukee County, bring people from the bus routes here, connect them to jobs in Waukesha. But right now,
it doesn't seem like that's really an option because of how they are able to spend their money. So can you unpack that a little bit?
Sure. So I think we basically have two problems from a local government perspective in our region, and really across the state, but specifically within our region. We have both a how we can use the funds problem and then just a straight up quantity of funds problem. You know, if Milwaukee County wanted to, or Waukesha County wanted to spend some of their funds on these sorts of services to extend the reach of the transit system into locations where the jobs are, they essentially have fixed budgets. That's due to limitations on property tax increases and the lack of revenue options for local governments. So from their local funding sources, these units of government would essentially have to decide what other places they want to cut services to make room for these additional extensions of the transit service through these partnerships with Uber, Lyft, or shared vans of some sort. And then they do have federal and state sources of funds that contribute to the transit systems. One thing that is kind of undergoing a national conversation right now is there are restrictions on how you use federal transit dollars that basically disqualify using it on these sorts of services. They have pretty rigorous drug testing for drivers and other limitations that make it very hard. It's not impossible, but make it very hard for a recipient of those funds to redirect them towards these sort of partnerships. There do seem to be some areas that maybe are getting a little bit of flexibility with that. So that could be something we could explore with the Federal Transit Administration partners on whether or not that's a possibility. But those are real challenges. I mean, there's a whole set of regulatory framework that was set up to fund, you know, 40-foot, 60-foot buses running on a fixed route. That's what these funds are designed for. And so modifying those on a national level to allow these sort of partnerships without allowing misuse and inappropriate use of the funds is something that they're always sensitive about.
Yeah. So these are essentially DOT regulations. I know my boyfriend is a UPS driver, and so I know he has very strict rules on mm-hmm. when he's able to drive, how many hours he can drive during the day, during the week. Is it those kinds of rules?
It is those types of rules. Yeah, those and others around, you know, drug-free workplaces and things like that. And I'm not suggesting that Uber and Lyft drivers necessarily, you know, are certainly on drugs or anything like that. But the rigorous testing around that, you know, most Uber and Lyft drivers aren't doing this as a full-time job. It's kind of a side gig. And so adding all sorts of layers of testing before you can be approved to be an Uber or Lyft driver is just unlikely to work under that model.
They are very strict rules. I should note, you know, mm-hmm. this is not something, you know, that you would expect for a part-time job, which is often.
Exactly. Yep. And that's exactly what it is.
Several people inside of these conversations have mentioned the Joseph Project. Can you explain what that is?
Sure. So my understanding of the Joseph Project is that it's run by a pastor out of Northside Church, and essentially he has put together a program where people show up at his church by a designated time. There's vans available, and they ride the correct van to wherever their job location is. And they, as part of getting ready for the program, they teach them soft skills and other things that are needed to make sure that they're a reliable employee of the businesses that are hiring them. And then the Joseph Project gets them there. They provide the drivers, they provide the vans, and gets them to the businesses and takes them home. It's a great initiative, definitely worthwhile. I would say that the ability to scale that at a metropolitan-wide level to all of our suburban business parks, I think, would be a challenge. That would be a lot of resources that entity would need. And the program, I think, really relies on some personal relationships with the individuals to make sure that this is useful to them, too. It's not just about providing labor. It's about getting those individuals' lives in a more stable and positive direction. And some of those types of programs require a lot of coaching and assistance. So that also affects your scalability, too.
A lot of one-on-one attention.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
So, you know, you mentioned Lyft and Uber as being some of the solutions. Are there other ways that people have tried to tackle the issue of specifically connecting suburban transit to transit in the central city? Because we do have buses that are in Waukesha County, but they function in different ways.
Yeah, I think that probably has more to do with the history of the origins of those systems. Both of the systems, well, the Milwaukee system was actually a private company first. Waukesha did once upon a time also have a private bus company, but that stopped operating and there was a pause before the public service started. But they were both intended to serve the areas that their jurisdictions are in. So back when Milwaukee County took over the transit system from the private company, most of our metro area jobs were in Milwaukee County. So it wasn't really a concern that those jobs were outside. The connectivity between those systems, there is a location where those systems connect. They both serve Brookfield Square, and you can make free transfers between those two systems at that location. Many other metro areas have regional transit agencies that maybe think about the system in a more comprehensive manner so that those transfers and that perception by the public of whether or not it's a different system is more seamless. And we don't have that here. So that does make a difference.
And is that something that would be possible to create? If Governor Evers said tomorrow, you know, this is a priority, I want to create a regional transit board for the Milwaukee area, is that something that he could do?
So there are options under state law to create transit commissions that go across municipal or county boundaries, but they are not able to generate their own revenue. So we would still have the same struggle of we don't have enough funding to actually provide the level of service that maybe some people are desiring for the metro area. We'd still struggle with that issue. The concept of regional transit authorities typically does assume that there would be some sort of dedicated funding source, like a sales tax or something like that, that would go directly to that transit authority. That's currently not permitted under state law, so it would require action by the state legislature as well as the signature of the governor to get that to happen.
Well, and it seems like that's the case in a lot of the solutions that we would ultimately be looking at, some kind of change at the state level.
Yes. I mean, part of this problem is just straight up a revenue problem. We don't have the funding that most metro areas of our size have. And because we don't have that funding, it limits our ability to be creative and try these different types of solutions to see which is the most efficient and the best solution to serve a certain area.
Yeah. You know, Sewer PAC has its Vision 2050. It's this larger regional plan for transit. Where did these kinds of issues fit into your larger plan?
Well, there are specific recommendations in the regional transportation plan about connecting essentially the entire urbanized part of the metro area and trying to build that connectivity. The plan mostly focuses on making the system faster and making sure it covers more areas. And when it comes to covering more areas, there are specific recommendations around providing creative solutions to suburban business parks. Because we know that in many cases, and as we've seen with the Route 57, it's not terribly efficient often to run a 40-foot bus through a single-use type commercial business park. There's just not that much activity happening in that business park. There's not much there other than the jobs. And so you want to make sure to provide access to those jobs for residents of the region, but you're not going to be filling a bus doing that. And so the kind of things we've talked about with shared taxis, shared vans, whether it's Uber, Lyft, or another entity, are part of the regional transportation plan and part of the solutions outlined there.
You know, ultimately, a lot does need to change in order to fix these issues. I recognize there's no silver bullet in this case. That's something that a number of people have said. But how do we make a more responsive transit system?
Sure. So looking at that less from like a governing structure perspective, because I think the Milwaukee County transit system and all of our transit systems in the region, frankly, do quite a bit with very little. And they're also extremely efficient relative to their peers. So they're a pretty good expenditure of taxpayer dollar compared to peer transit systems across the country. But putting that aside, I think that there is an opportunity to look at who are the beneficiaries of anything we pursue and see if there's a way to marry maybe philanthropic interests and the businesses who are benefiting with labor force, as well as maybe a bit of either state or local contribution on a small level to kind of manage it and make it cohesive to build a solution. There is, at the Regional Planning Commission, we've been working towards trying to develop those solutions, kind of piecing things together. We have an initiative called the Workforce Mobility Team, where we are trying to work with businesses that are interested in solving these problems across the region to provide better access to those jobs and increase their labor force pool. But I think there really is a struggle to find a comprehensive solution without enabling local governments to really take it on. And so that's a real challenge. But I do think we can make some progress without that still.
Yeah. Well, Kevin Muse, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and speaking with me today.
Thank you for having me.
Kevin Muse is the executive director of the Southeastern Wisconsin Regional Planning Commission, and he wraps up our series on the end of the job lines. You can hear segments from the full series this Saturday and Sunday on Lake Effect Weekend, or you can head to our website, wuwm.com, to hear more of those stories. We'll take a short break now, and then astronomy contributor Gene Creighton joins us to share some statistics on how the phases of the moon actually affect our behavior. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues now on WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. 2019 has been the summer of the moon. 50 years ago, humans landed on it, and over the past few months, we've been looking back at the history of the space race and ahead at what future missions might look like. Astronomy contributor Gene Creighton joins us now to talk with Bonnie North about a different aspect of the moon.
I have been struck by how people engage with the moon. And it's not always from a scientific point of view, like, you know, what do we find on the moon or why are we going to the moon for a scientific purpose. They really engage with the moon because it's beautiful and, I think, to some extent, because lots of people think that somehow the moon affects us people. We know that it affects tides, right? We know that there are aspects of the moon that impact our planet. And I guess that might make lots of people think that, well, surely if it can change the tides, it can move oceans on Earth, surely it might have some influence on us. And to give it as much credit as, you know, as I can as a scientist, you know, it makes sense. We're 75% water. You might think that, you know, there's some connection.
That there would be some pull.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That somehow that influences us. We have talked about the lunar effect. So this idea that somehow people are influenced specifically from the full moon has been known since the Middle Ages, and it's called the Transylvania effect. From a cultural point of view, we should acknowledge that calendars are often based on the lunar cycle. So all of that is perfectly wonderful.
Oh, and a lot of various religions, sun and moon had very specific meanings and people assigned different things.
Of course. Yeah. And even to this day, the fact that we have the longest day or the shortest day impacts our mood, impacts what we want to do, what we need to do. And that's why so often an astronomical event, the solstice is undeniable in these latitudes, they usurp whatever culture is, usurps that day and uses it to its own
purposes.
You know, so means.
Yeah.
So I've been interested in this idea that people are impacted. Somehow their behavior changes and becomes more erratic when the moon is full. When I discuss this with groups of people, invariably there are nurses or other people who work in the health field, and they'll say, oh, yeah, emergency is really busy when the moon is full. And I was surprised to see that 40% of all people in the medical sciences, in the medical field, thinks that somehow the full moon does impact people. So I thought, surely there are studies about this. Surely there are numbers that we can find about this potential association. And there are dozens of studies for all kinds of things, from accidents, from emergency room visits, from births, all kinds of ways that people have tested whether there are correlations. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean there's causation, but at least if you looked at the plot of births, let's say, for different phases of the moon, would you see some kind of peak around the full moon? So I looked at a bunch of studies, and I'm gonna actually talk numbers. I normally don't talk about numbers, but we're not talking small number statistics here. We're talking about pretty large studies and what the findings are. So I'm going to start with service calls to the police department. This was a study over 8 years for 908,000 service calls. No correlation.
So almost a million calls, and they found nothing.
Nothing. The phase of the moon just doesn't come into it. And I'm going to round up the number so I don't tell you to the last, but around 25,500 psychiatric emergency visits during a 13-year period increased during the first quarter a bit and decreased during the new moon and the full moon. 65,000 suicides in 3 years, no correlation. 350,000 injuries in a 36-year period, slight decrease during the full moon. This is the biggest one. Over 38 years in the southwestern part of Germany, 4,071,000 births, no correlation. So this is an interesting statistic, and I'm not saying it last because I want that thing to be left with you last, but I'm just saying this for your entertainment. 843,000 traffic accidents that required an emergency transport over a period of 5 years affected or had higher numbers of males involved and people over 40 when the moon was full. This was not seen for females or men under 40.
Interesting.
Interesting. But I should also point out that these studies that involve the moon phases are really tricky because not all of them correct for the fact that that full moon fell on a Saturday. We know that weekends have higher accident rates. We know that holidays do. And some of these studies just don't correct for that. So these studies can be notoriously tricksy to kind of tease out what is the important thing and what isn't. But what I hope to communicate to everyone is that this is not so clear-cut as people might think. And it's certainly not a given that, oh, you know, the moon is full, therefore everybody's acting crazy. Two things of note. One of them is that in the Middle Ages, we know that barley had a particular fungus that was a hallucinogen. So during the Middle Ages, it could well be that when the moon was full, you were able to see more of this strange behavior. And I wonder whether this is the root of where this whole Transylvania effect comes from.
You're talking about literally see more.
Because, yeah, literally.
Of course, they didn't have lights.
That's right. That's right. So you depended on the moon to be able to see. And the full moon, of course, is dramatic. We've all seen that. That certainly makes it possible to see things that otherwise you wouldn't be able to. The other thing is what we call the confirmation bias. And that is if I walk into a situation thinking that, I'm going to see more people in emergency when the moon is full. If I have a rough shift and I'm going home and I notice the full moon, I'll think, see, I told you, obviously, yeah. If, however, I come home from a crazy day to the hospital and I don't see the full moon, I don't record that as saying, oh, that's evidence against what I think. You don't notice. And I'm not saying that people are trying to distort the information. That's just our tendency. We tend to notice things that confirm what we already thought.
Right. I was going to say, I wonder, had any of these studies shown that there was a slight increase or any increase at all, if that's because we were expecting on the full moon to have more accidents or to see people crazy. So, of course, we're reporting more of it. But even with that confirmation bias in place, you're saying the numbers don't back up any of it.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. So I think that's really interesting that sometimes we hold on to ideas that when you just look at the straight up data, it doesn't confirm those ideas as strongly as we think.
We are a romantic species. And we want to think that those things, I think. We make stories.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, you look up and you go, oh, of course, it's the full moon. No wonder that person cut me off. And no wonder the cat's jumping around. And no wonder. And I mean, I will guiltily do that too. Say, oh, of course, it's the full moon. Even if I don't really believe that.
Right.
You know,
that's
it's
right.
Kind of an easy cultural reference, I think.
Right. And
yeah.
Lots of people nod and smile and say, oh, sure. Yeah, of course.
Right. And so it reconfirms. And so we keep doing it.
That's right.
We are so predictable, you know, we're a lot more predictable than we think we are.
Yeah. On the other hand, I think it's useful to say that the presence of the full moon, as you say, does make us romantics, does yield beautiful poetry, beautiful songs. So it does affect us in a positive way. And it connects us to people in other parts of the world. It connects us to our history. We've been looking at that nearest companion of ours for as long as people have been looking up.
So we'll keep romanticizing it, but just remember the numbers don't back it up.
Right.
All right, Jean. Well, thank you so much for bursting that bubble.
Okay.
And I look forward to chatting with you next month.
Thanks so much.
Lake Effects astronomy contributor Jean Creighton is the director of the Manfred Olson Planetarium located on the UWM campus. You can find more of our conversations with her at WUWM.com. More of Lake Effect Now on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers. Contributor Jennifer Fields invites you to take a second look at the things you choose to keep near. That's the basis of material culture. Its purpose is not to look at the history of objects, but rather to look at history through objects. Sarah Ann Carter is a visiting scholar at the School of Human Ecology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She's also the author of Object Lessons, How 19th Century Americans Learned to Make Sense of the Material World. It describes how formal interaction with objects in school helped children develop the ability to make sense of the world. In this final edition of Radio Chipstone, Fields and Carter talk about how 19th century schools for Native and African Americans, like the Tuskegee Institute, took the general principles of object lessons and applied them to people.
The object lesson idea was incredibly popular in the late 19th century and really was an educational fad in a lot of ways. And this educational fad was something that also became quite popular at the Hampton Normal School. The Hampton Normal and Agricultural Institute in Hampton, Virginia. Hampton was founded in the years after the Civil War as a school to educate African Americans, many of whom had been enslaved and their children. It also was a place to educate Native Americans. And at Hampton, the object lesson idea was not just part of the curriculum in the same way that it was in primary schools and in schools for children across the United States. At Hampton, the object lesson idea was employed not just to teach the students there, but to truly transform them into living object lessons. Into living object lessons of what could be made of educated African American and Native American students. So as one of the leaders of Hampton described, you know, at Hampton there are 90, and at Carlisle there are nearly 300 Indians, boys and girls, who are learning civilization as an object lesson, and are themselves an object lesson. And the idea here was that they were learning through the object lesson method, but they were also living object lessons. Those students and their bodies were to be transformed into a lesson in what could be made of African American and Native American students who went through this program. At Hampton, they taught students a whole range of industrial skills, industrial training. Whether it was carpentry or bricklaying or shoemaking. Part of what's so fascinating and strange about this is that some of those skills were, like shoemaking, were pretty outmoded by this point. And so part of what they're teaching students how to do in the late 19th century at Hampton is the idea is they're teaching students what it means to work hard and trying to make that become a quality of those students. So just as in the object lesson, you'd be studying a material thing and you would try to understand its qualities. What are the qualities that makes this a hunk of sugar or that makes this a piece of ginger or that makes this a porcelain cup? What are the qualities, the material qualities? But in this case, they're saying we want hard work to be a quality of the bodies of these African American students and these Native American students. The idea was that this was sending those students out into the world as people who had learned how to work so that they would become object lessons in what could be made of an African American or a Native American student. So this whole pedagogy, as it was understood at Hampton and at the Carlisle Indian School and at other schools like that, was predicated on this notion that African Americans and Native Americans needed to be taught how to work and needed to be taught how to think. And these incredibly racist notions were really at the foundation for these schools that were on the one hand trying to educate these students, but on the other hand to educate them for particular social roles that they believed would be beneficial for society and for these students. So for example, Booker T. Washington, you know, described what it would be like for students going out into the world coming from Hampton. He said, "Hampton, Tuskegee, and other institutions have been able, year after year, to present Southern white people object lessons, showing the value of an educated colored man, letting them see that an educated man was a help rather than a hindrance to the progress of the South." So it was a way to try to shape and control the possibilities or futures of these students. And I think a lot about that idea when I think about issues related, say, to racial profiling today in the 21st century. I think a lot about that idea when faced with questions about, well, what does a citizen look like? What does a person look like who might be viewed by some aspects of society as being a successful and productive member of society? Well, a lot of those ideas and questions go back to this object lesson idea.
Just as people then were to be viewed or being object lessons in the sense of hard workers who appeared and did this work and didn't talk back and didn't step out of line, now people of color are viewed in these very narrow ideas of who we are and what we're able to do and how we should be moving in this world. If that makes any sense.
It does make sense, because what you're helping to frame, Jennifer, is that the object lesson idea gets us right into thinking about stereotypes, and it gets us right into thinking about how the object lesson method allows you to go from observation to abstract idea about a material thing, but also, as it was applied to people, it allows you to go from observation looking at a person to coming up with a whole world of ideas about that person. In places like Hampton, it was, "We're going to teach you what it means to look like a productive member of society. And then when you go out in the world, when someone sees you, your citizenship and your right to engage is based on how you look, not on your natural rights as a person that you have, should have, but what you look like," right? So just in the same way, if we take this object lesson idea and you say you look at someone, you might make assumptions about that person, about their world, because of cultural stereotypes, rather than meeting each person where they are. So the object lesson idea can be this powerful way to study material things, but it can often be a very dangerous way to study and think about people, because it encourages you to, based on your observations and experiences, make assumptions about that person. It's a pedagogy that has a fascinating history and some real possibility for thinking about teaching children how to open up their minds when you start engaging with material things. But it has some really dangerous and troubling possibilities when it comes to talking about people, talking about stereotypes.
It's taking, Sarah, one aspect of object lesson and running away with it, taking one aspect of it, and it's not necessarily looking at that object through a lens that's an objective lens. It's a lens that's informed by a cultural superiority, a European cultural superiority, rather than meeting that person and engaging with them where they are and by who they are. You're taking another lens and taking a small portion of an object lesson and using that to base all of your information.
Right, exactly. And in some ways, that process really shows how effective the object lesson rhetoric is. Right? Because you want to be able to go from seeing something to immediately understanding it. It becomes this cultural shorthand, right? Okay, it's an object lesson. I see it. I understand the idea. I understand the abstract idea. When, of course, if one actually went through a lesson like that, you'd begin to see the complexity. You'd begin to see, wow, there might be things that I'm observing or that I'm seeing or sensing, but then there's information I cannot get just from what I see, which was, of course, part of the object lesson method. And then thinking about categorization or sorting, there are things that I don't know just from this thing. I have to understand its context. I have to understand where this object or this person came from, what their world is like, what their life is like, what choices are available to them, what they find exciting, what makes them happy, all of those things. And then finally, the last step in an object lesson is putting all of that information together and trying to make sense of the world through it. when object lessons are applied in that shorthand way, as they were at Hampton or Tuskegee, or as the object lesson idea is misshapen into notions of stereotypes, you miss all of those steps. You're just going from what you see to an idea. You're not thinking through that process. You're not trying to understand and engage and connect and do that critical thinking work, which really was at the foundation of this pedagogy.
Contributor Jennifer Fields curates the Radio Chipstone series. She spoke with Sarah Ann Carter, a visiting scholar in design and material culture studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Her book is called Object Lessons: How 19th Century Americans Learned to Make Sense of the Material World. We'll take one last break, and then Fit for You visits a yoga studio that encourages parents to bring in their kids. Lake Effect continues with that conversation in a moment on 89.7 WUWM. More of Lake Effect Now, I'm Joy Powers.
It's a trucky truck.
While you may be familiar with that chant practiced in yoga, it may be unexpected to hear kids playing during this stereotypically Zen moment. There are plenty of yoga classes at local gyms and even studios dedicated to the practice, but finding pre- and postnatal yoga is still pretty tough. For expecting and new parents, it's often hard to coordinate getting somewhere to exercise, especially if childcare is involved. One local yoga instructor wanted to fill the void by creating a place for parents to come not just for yoga, but for community. Amy Kranz is the founder of the Womb Room in Milwaukee. She joins Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski in the studio for this month's Fit for You segment. Kranz explains that pre- and postnatal yoga is about more than poses and breathing exercises.
Some of it is about the yoga and the postures and getting to know your body. And a big piece of it is about creating community with other people that are pregnant and postpartum. So for me, the emphasis is on not just including a pregnant person in a regular yoga class in a way that's safe for them, but creating community with other people that are in the same phase of life and in a way that feels safe, in a way that feels where we can feel better in our bodies and our hearts and our minds when we walk away from it. So I guess it's wonderful to have a teacher, a yoga teacher, be trained in prenatal yoga. It's another thing to create a community for people that are in that phase of life with the benefit of you're doing yoga together.
Exactly.
See what I'm saying? So the community is primary and the yoga is bonus rather than the other way around.
Right. So before we touch upon your physical space and the community you're creating, can you touch upon how pre- and postnatal yoga differ from a typical yoga format class that anyone could walk into a studio or, say, their local gym that offers classes? You know, what are women's bodies experiencing during this time that you are being mindful of in adjusting positions or breath or body awareness?
Yeah, there's a lot of pieces. So another job that I have is as a birth doula. And so there are pieces that go into prenatal yoga that are really about preparing for birth. So preparing to be more connected to your breath, preparing to open up the body in a certain way to allow baby to move out more easily. So I think that at least in the focus of my classes, I try to sort of replicate the labor journey in the class so that the rhythm of labor is something that's sort of installed in them before they actually end up in the physical journey of labor. So maybe starting out with slower movements where they're getting in touch with their body, but they're not quite so taxed by the positions that they're in. It's sort of a turning inward, turning in and tuning in to ourselves and our babies, and then slowly building that workload until we get up to the really, really intense things like maybe a squat or a goddess pose or a warrior sequence where they really can look at the edge of their physicality and say, you know, I can't, if they can even say inside of their minds, I can't do this, that's going to happen to pretty much everybody when they're in labor. And so if you can get to that point where you can feel the feeling of, I can't do this. Before you're in labor, you can realize what the thoughts are that go along with that, what your breath, how your breath changes when that happens. So it's a way of sort of feeling out the gesture of birth before you're actually in the birth journey itself. Even in the postpartum, and as parents in general, we see that rhythm over and over again, the rhythm of this is pretty intense, but then all of a sudden, next thing you know, everybody's having a tantrum at once in the middle of Aldi, and you're just trying to get out of the grocery store. And you're like, I can't do this. I can't do this. And then you tap into something. So these skills that they're working with in class, they can use anywhere. And I guess that's part of the reason, too, that I include or that we include the children in the class as far as being in the physical space with us, because this is not meant to be a practice that we take outside of our lives and doesn't in any way translate into our lives. We want it to translate into our lives. We want our lives to be from a place of more comfort and ease and steadiness.
Oh, no, I made it up.
Everything's optional, so every posture is optional. Getting off of your mat is optional. Saying bag it and laying down and taking a nap is optional. Whatever you need to do is okay, and whatever they need to do is okay. So.
Right. Some people may think it's counterintuitive to go to a yoga class where your kids are also there with you and they are playing in the back corner, perhaps having a little tantrum, whatever the needs may be, or perhaps you need to stop to breastfeed your child. You know, when people typically think of yoga as going into this zen zone, it's completely quiet, you know, a little too quiet for people sometimes.
Right.
But for parents, you can't escape this.
Right.
In your everyday. It's your 24/7.
Right.
So what have you heard from mothers who couldn't find this kind of space before? Because a lot of times mothers, whether it's pre or postnatal, they have difficulties finding gyms that
yes.
perhaps offer a daycare, or, you know, they simply can't find the childcare to go
right.
away and take a class themselves.
Yeah. I think it's what I've heard is that it's a huge relief to be able to come to class and not have to find somewhere for the kids. And the other thing is just there are some parents who are – it's really anxiety provoking to think of leaving their kids in a childcare facility, even if it's within the gym itself. So the fact that they can be there and at the same time they have their own space, everything is childproof, so you don't have to worry about danger that way. And they also get to experience acceptance towards themselves, their journey towards each other and their own parenting journey. And as everything happens, everything just happens. We're working also on not judging ourselves, not judging each other, not judging each other's children. If somebody throws a yoga block at your face, or how many times we've had toddlers that have like taken a bite out of an infant. Or something.
Right,
like
right.
Not literally. But the, you know, working with that, that's a big piece and a big, it's a stressful piece of parenting is being with other parents and wondering whether or not you're being judged or not, whether your child's behavior is being judged or not. And so having that safe space to go, we're all kind of in this together and we're all invested in these kids, not just our own kids, but all the kids that are here. And so seeing them as human beings instead of as the kid that threw the block in my head during Shavasana.
So the fact that this space is also childproof mm-hmm. must be a big relief to the participants coming in here. So can you describe your physical space
sure.
within the studio that would make it different compared to a typical yoga studio one would visit?
Yeah, it's all in an open space. So it started out just as a basement, a finished basement, and then a bunch of people, different people, birth workers and people interested in supporting families this way got together and did everything from creating the physical space, picking out the paint colors to visioning what would be offered. So all, you know, at all different levels of support. And the space that we came up with, I think, is really multifunctional for all those different kinds of offerings and also is childproofed. So it's safe for little people to come to the support groups. So it's not just yoga that they can come to. They can come to the other things that their parents might come to. There's a cloth diaper class. Yesterday there was a potty training class. So those sorts of things. If you can't, you know, for some parents, maybe they want to go have a potty training class, but they don't have anywhere to put their toddler when they're at the potty training class. So being able to have kids come along is, I think, a relief for parents.
Right. I mean, you mentioned the womb to tomb. So it's very much a place that you want people to be able to access throughout their entire journeys from before becoming parents onward. And that big community aspect that comes with that. A lot of times new parents can feel very isolated. You know, just the schedules of taking care of a newborn is very trying.
Right.
So how do you facilitate a place that continues to reinforce that message, that this is your community?
I think it's a couple of things. So one thing is just on the micro level of being in the yoga class and going around in the beginning of class and having everyone introduce themselves, tell us when they're due, tell us about their kids, and then answer a question. So we have a community developing question of some sort. So we always have an affirmation, and then on that affirmation, we have a question. So it might be something simple like, what's your favorite guilty pleasure? If your baby was named after your food cravings, what would it be named? And then all the way to, how is your mood? How was your birth?
I want you to just tell us a little bit about, so the affirmation is, it doesn't have to be tidy, it's just honest. So tell us a little thing that you want to whine about.
I get shoes thrown at me, I get hit, and then we come here and, oh, she's sweet as pie, right? Sweet as pie here.
Look at her face. You know, I find it really difficult to balance two kids by myself, so that's why she's in daycare, and I feel really guilty because I work.
I just don't like being tired, because then I just feel on edge, and I need more yoga and meditation.
So it can really run the gamut, and so allows the people that participate to really normalize what can happen in parenting, in birth, in pregnancy. So it's not as if anyone's thinking to themselves, well, my position was like this, and that is so weird from what everybody else's was. Or the opposite, what's happening for me is what's happening for everybody else. I find that people really sift themselves into those two categories. And so
well, we have a lot of expectations put on ourselves or by society of what a successful, quote, you know,
absolutely.
Parent is.
And if you're not doing that, you figure that you're not doing that and everybody else is doing that. The other piece that's kind of broader than that is that we really want for the space to be a space for conversation. And so that means that it's not only sort of supporting people that are pregnant, birthing, and postpartum, but it's also supporting how, which ways in which we marginalize different people, different conversations. So marginalizing mental health, marginalizing around race. So trying to create space to pull out of the margins ways in which people are not served in birthing and postpartum and pregnancy, but also in other parts of life. Like, how are we supporting families and different families in the way that families can look different? How are we supporting people that don't have access to the services that people that are from a higher socioeconomic bracket have access to? So like if you look at the natural birthing world, there is really, and it overlaps with yoga, right? So yoga and the natural birthing world have in common that they are accessible to a certain segment of society. And so from both of those perspectives, looking outside of that segment and going, how can, if we really know that these things work, if we really know that creating community helps to give relief, it should be accessible in a broader way than it has been in the past. Same thing with yoga. If I know that yoga is great for preparing someone for birth, if I know that it's a great tool for pregnancy and postpartum, then I want it to be accessible beyond the boundaries of where it's been accessible. And so starting to think about, like, what are the ways in which it isn't accessible? Is it because we haven't worked hard enough to create a space that seems safe and inclusive? And so how can we be transparent about how we're making that happen?
Well, how do you tackle the challenge of bringing in newcomers? You know, perhaps they haven't even done yoga before, but here's a community and a space that is more than about yoga being a fitness routine, but an inclusive practice.
Yeah. It's so word of mouth. word of mouth is so important. I think the safety piece, for sure, needs to be communicated from someone that's been in the circle out. Because rarely will I get somebody who is nervous about maybe the mental health piece or nervous about a person of color who doesn't necessarily want to come into a white space. Rarely do you see someone like that just come out of the woodwork. It's somehow it's been communicated that this space is a place for conversation. This is not a place where we're taking anything for granted. And it's built, at least the yoga piece, built some on the foundation of me already having been a teacher for a long time. So there was that piece too. Then there are so many birth workers that work in the space too. And so they, I think, just the inclusion of birth workers creates a level of safety.
Well, and keeping those things in mind, how did you find yourself changing your instructional practice from going from a traditional yoga setting, but then incorporating it into this new setting and also incorporating, you know, your experience as a mother yourself, your educational background in psychology? What kind of things, because you truly had the freedom to form your new practice in your new space. You weren't at the dictation of, say, a gym's guidelines or things. So what were you mindful of and what did you want to accomplish in your own teaching?
I think it's always been really important to me to have a trauma-sensitive perspective. Being a birth doula and experiencing what birth can look like and making sure to include that interoception, so the cueing that this teaching, this work is happening from your body out, not from my instruction on to your body. So I think the mental health piece has always been just right there at the top for me. And also, it's essential also to me that my use of yoga be constantly examined as well, because it's not a tradition that belongs to me as a white person. It's not a tradition that I just can take for granted and say, oh, I want to have this piece and this piece, but I don't want to have this piece. And so that's important to me too. I guess the big piece with the psychology is just the understanding that the body is the doorway in a lot of times to mental health issues, to the healing of trauma. And so what better modality than to be including the body and listening to the body and trusting the wisdom of the body at the same time as finding some stability in our minds and in our hearts. In my experience, you can't do it without it.
We're going to finish up our practice by chanting together.
Amy Kranz is a yoga instructor and founder of The Womb Room in Milwaukee. She spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski as part of our monthly Fit for You series. You can hear more of our Fit for You conversations at WUWM.com, as well as an extended interview with Kranz. And that's today's edition of the show. I'm Joy Powers, Bonnie North, and Audrey Nowakowski join me in producing Lake Effect each week with help from Ben Binversi, Zoe Munson, and Cassidy Schrader. We also get support from the WUWM Newsroom, including Mayan Silver, Latoya Dennis, and Chuck Quirnbach this week. Lauren Sigfusson is our digital producer, Jason Reavy is our studio engineer, and Michelle Matanowski is our managing editor. Willie Porter wrote our theme music. Thanks so much for tuning in today, and I hope you can be with us again Saturday and Sunday afternoon at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. It's 11 o'clock, and stay tuned. Fresh Air is next.